You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Catherine Patterson. This is the WFHB local news for Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021.
1005 is a struggle. I mean, it is a blatant attack on public schools in an effort to privatize. It's also, it's not about choice. It's not about serving students who are most vulnerable, students of color. It's not. It's about taking care of wealthy families.
Later in the program, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti for a report on newly proposed state education bills that would take money from public schools and give it to private schools. Stay tuned to hear that interview.
Also coming up in the next half hour, workers at the Secretly Group, a string of Bloomington-based record labels, are trying to unionize. More in today's headlines. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Tuesday, March 23rd. I'm Jake Jacobson. As of Monday, Hoosiers who are 40 years of age and older are currently eligible to sign up for the COVID-19 vaccine. Pre-K through high school teachers and staff, as well as Hoosiers who work in childcare, are also eligible. First responders and healthcare workers still qualify to sign up as well. If you qualify, you can sign up online by visiting ourshot.in.gov, over the phone by calling 211 for assistance, or by contacting one of Indiana's area agencies on aging. Governor Eric Holcomb's latest executive order, Executive Order 21-07, went into effect on Monday. Executive Order 21-07 extends the deadline to file state taxes from April 15th to May 17th. This change is in line with recent announcements that the U.S. Treasury has extended the federal tax deadline to May 17th as well. The executive order makes two other major extensions. First, EO 21-07 continues to extend the temporary licensing of healthcare workers for an additional 90 days. EO 21-07 also extends the amount of time a new police officer in Indiana can, quote, exercise law enforcement powers, end quote, before they are required to complete basic training. This additional 6 months is on top of the current allotted time of 1 year. This is the second such extension granted to members of law enforcement made by Governor Holcomb. These multiple extensions are due to the closure of the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Curiously, the state's press release does not touch on this particular extension. That's all for your local news brief. From WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
Development Services Manager Jackie Scanlon presented an ordinance amendment to the Unified Development Ordinance regarding use regulations during the March 22nd Bloomington Plan Commission meeting. She spoke of changes to parking regulations.
The first is related to multifamily, and basically it's a regulation on indoor parking. So, there is currently no language limiting the amount of ground floor of a building that can be used for parking. So what we are proposing is that similar to what we do on a site when parking is visible outside of the building, that inside of the building, if you're going to have a built-in parking garage, that you do have to set it back at least 20 feet from the public facade that's facing a street. So that there's room there for another use, a lobby or a commercial use or something of that nature to help improve the interface between your building and the public right-of-way so that it's not just a blank wall because on the other side there are cars and the only other option would be, you know, an open traditional parking lot or, having lights out onto the street. So we have proposed to have that set back in the building for multifamily use.
Scanlon said a similar requirement was proposed for student living. She mentioned changes to livestock regulations as well.
And then we would also be proposing that in the code now, how many animals you have is regulated by how much pasture you have. But for small livestock, a lot of them don't necessarily need pasture, some are hand fed or just need smaller areas. So we've changed the small livestock regulation to be based on whether or not you meet minimum lot size for your zoning district, and left the others as pasturage based, because typically a medium or large animal will definitely need some sort of pasturage to be well sustained. So that will allow smaller livestock on smaller lots in town than otherwise would if we did require pasturage for those as well.
Scanlon proposed removal of a required notification to neighbors if a person's planned on building an accessory dwelling unit. She mentioned the notification caused confusion.
Functionally, it's kind of created confusion, as some of our other items we'll get to later also have, for members of the public, because they're receiving this letter and then there isn't really anything they can do about it because it's a by right approval. They could potentially appeal to the Board of Zoning Appeals, but as long as the ADU is meeting all of the requirements, that wouldn't be probably very fruitful because it is a by right use now. So we are proposing to actually take that notification out.
Scanlon stated no other by right uses require notification. During public comment, many residents supported resident Peter Dorfman's opposition to the removal of notification.
I get it that it's permitted and there's nothing legally that a neighbor could do to prevent construction of an ADU if they objected. And I know that you can't legislate private disputes between individuals, but notification serves a really important purpose in avoiding the need for those disputes. If people have the opportunity to know what's coming, they can enter into a discussion and maybe iron out something that could become a problem down the road and really doesn't need to. If we were talking about enclosing a front porch or, even adding a carport, that would be one thing. But, I'm aware of, in my neighborhood, two ADUs, detached ADUs that have been built in the last couple of years. They are two-story apartment over garage. And a structure like that changes the landscape. If you're a serious gardener, a two-story building placed in a way that blocks the sunlight that you want on your garden, it may not sound like a big deal, but it could cause a serious disagreement between neighbors that could become really unpleasant.
Commissioner Tron Enright Randolph supported the continuance of notification letters. Commissioner Beth Kate argued neighbor conversations could still occur without a required formal notification. Commissioners unanimously approved a positive recommendation of the ordinance to City Council as amended.
Workers at the independent record company, The Secretly Group, started an effort to unionize. The Secretly Group is made up of four indie labels, which include Secretly Canadian, Jag Jag UR, Dead Oceans, and archival record label The Numero Group. Kim Kelly of Rolling Stone magazine reported that if successful, the Secretly Group union will make history as one of the first independent record label staffs to unionize. Employees wrote in an open letter, quote, "Our enthusiasm for the culture and when we work can lead to exploitation in ways endemic to the creative industries. Poor wages, inadequate benefits, and an absence of initiatives that address systemic race and gender inequality," end quote. According to the Secretly Group union's Twitter page, workers at the label hope to form a union with the Office of Professional Employees International Union, or OPEIU. In the open letter, union organizers are asking senior partners and senior management at the Secretly Group to voluntarily recognize the union. Demands of the Secretly Group's workers include fair compensation, equitable representation, and healthy working conditions. The story of the Secretly Group has humble beginnings, which stemmed from several college radio students putting money together from their summer jobs to start a record label. It was founded by brothers Chris and Ben Swanson, along with friends Eric Weddle and Jonathan Cargill,
at Indiana University in 1996. Now the Secretly Group has offices in London and Paris. Its rosters include artists from Yoko Ono to The War on Drugs to Phoebe Bridgers. Now, workers are hoping to write a new chapter of the Secretly legacy. The letter says, quote, "The Secretly Group has been a leading progressive voice in the music industry for many years. Unionization ensures that we will continue to set that example for our peers. This is the next chapter of the Secretly legacy, written by the workers," end quote. To view the full statement, visit WFHB.org following this broadcast.
The Ellettsville Town Council discussed traffic ordinances during their March 22nd meeting. Town Attorney Dalla Brown introduced the ordinances for first reading.
One, to amend Chapter 74 of the traffic schedule to designate no parking areas. And specifically, those streets that are being added are Abigail Lane on the no parking, as well as Jackie Court, Nicholas Lane, Rachel Way, and that is it for that particular ordinance.
Brown stated the second ordinance concerned maximum speed limits for the same roadways. She stated the limit would be set at 20 miles per hour. Councilmember Scott Oldham questioned Public Works Forum Kip Heddy about speed limit comparisons.
Is this consistent with all of our other neighborhood streets or addition streets?
As far as speed, or I mean,
20 mile an hour.
Okay, all the town, throughout the whole town, is basically 20 mile an hour. What streets we've annexed in the last couple of years that are like the counties, they stay at 30 mile an hour for the most part. I think part of Vine Street, it may be 15 mile an hour. That would be from like behind the old Village Inn, maybe all the way to Sell Street. I'm not sure. But for the most part, all of town is 20 mile an hour speed limit.
Council members will hold a final discussion regarding the street ordinances at their next council meeting.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Alex Dederer reports on a weight room disparity between the men's and women's teams at the NCAA's basketball tournament. We turn to Alex Dederer for more.
NCAA officials apologized for a weight room disparity between the women's and men's basketball teams in the NCAA tournaments hosted in San Antonio and Indianapolis. Lynn Holzman, the NCAA's vice president of women's basketball, acknowledged the difference between the women's training facility in San Antonio and the men's facility in Indianapolis.
I wanted to start first by just addressing the elephant in the room, which is some of the things that have been shared relative to the experience of our 64 teams here in San Antonio, and specifically one item relative to availability of a weight room. I'm a former women's basketball student athlete, and it's always been my priority to make this event the best possible experience for everyone involved. This is my passion. I care about women's basketball and women in sport. We fell short this year in what we've been doing to prepare in the last 60 days for 64 teams to be here in San Antonio. And we acknowledge that.
Sedona Prince, a forward for the University of Oregon, posted a video last week on the video sharing social media app TikTok. The video showed the disparity between the women's and men's training facilities. It showed the women's weight room as a handful of dumbbells, while the men's teams had far more sophisticated equipment.
I got something to show y'all. So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room. Now, when pictures of our weight room got released versus the men's, the NCAA came out with a statement saying that it wasn't money, it was space that was a problem. Let me show y'all something else. Here's our practice court, right? And then here's that weight room. And then here's all this extra space. If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it.
Longtime Notre Dame coach Muffet McGraw said she was not surprised by the weight room differences. She said, quote, "The fact that there's a huge disparity between men's and women's sports is hardly breaking news. The NCAA had an opportunity to highlight how sport can be a place where we don't just talk about equality, we put it on display. To say they dropped the ball would be the understatement of the year," end quote. Within hours of the viral video, the NCAA held a conference call with coaches and administrators. Holzman said changes would be implemented by the end of the weekend.
Last night, we did have a call with our coaches and the team administrators. We called that together as a way to solicit feedback and input on their experience thus far. Yesterday was the first day that our teams had the opportunity to all 64 to actually have practice, or as those were coming out of quarantine. And part of that call was to get feedback on potential solutions to address some of those concerns, including the weight room issue. We are actively working on that and things that will be in place by tomorrow morning.
On Saturday, the NCAA received an upgraded weight room for the women's teams participating in the San Antonio tournament. Lastly, the NCAA received criticism for its use of rapid antigen COVID-19 tests for the women's tournament, while using the more accurate polymerase chain reaction testing for the men's tournament. NCAA President Mark Emmert said the Athletic Association had, quote, "complete confidence in all the medical protocols that have been put together," end quote.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti for a report on newly proposed state education bills that would take money from public schools and give it to private schools.
In February 2021, teachers across Indiana protested Republican education funding bill proposals that would give an unprecedented amount of money to private and charter schools, as well as to voucher programs, the state government schemes which give families money to send their kids to private schools. The teachers' protest was called Blackout for Ed, and the teachers wore black to bring attention to the new bills. They also took to social media to get the word out, taking pictures and videos of their protest and voicing their concerns. Chiefly among them was the unprecedented state funding of private schools. The bills winding their way through the Indiana State Legislature would allocate a third of the new education budget to the 5% of Indiana students that go to private schools. That means that the Indiana state government would be providing private schools with almost 10 times more funding per student than public schools. Three former Indiana state superintendents have come out against the bill. They published a letter decrying the bill as laying the groundwork for furthering social inequalities by reducing public school funding and freezing teacher compensation. Here's what former Indiana Superintendent Jennifer McCormick had to say about the bill in an interview with television station WPTA 21.
1005 is a struggle. I mean, it is a blatant attack on public schools in an effort to privatize. It's not about choice. It's not about serving students who are most vulnerable, students of color. It's not. It's about taking care of wealthy families and making sure that the money follows the wealth.
Now, proponents of the bill and of voucher programs generally say that it's important for the government to pay for private schooling because it gives families more choices and options when choosing a school. Representative Bob Benning is one of the authors of the proposed budget bill called House Bill 1005. He is a member of the state House of Representatives, and he's the Education Committee chairperson. He used to work as a florist, and he is an administrator at the private Marion University in Indianapolis. In a video published by the Indiana Republican Party, Representative Benning was asked about the voucher program. Here was his response.
Giving the students and the parents the opportunity to make that choice helps improve overall academic performance, and hopefully our students will flourish and become productive citizens in our state.
In 2015, Representative Benning submitted an application to the Indiana House Ethics Committee to work as an out-of-state, for-profit education industry lobbyist. His application raised a number of red flags, and he was ultimately forced to withdraw it. Perhaps Benning's main lobbying connection is with his 8-year tenure as the Alec State Chairman for Indiana from 1996 to 2004. Alec, which is short for American Legislation Exchange Council, is a conservative organization which writes laws for conservative politicians to introduce and enact in national and state legislatures. Lawmakers are supposed to author their own bills, but there are a number of documented cases of lawmakers actually forgetting to delete the Alec name off of the author section of the model legislation. Following a number of media exposés on the organization's campaign to further corporate interests, a number of lawmakers and corporations have withdrawn their membership from Alec in recent years. In addition to Stand Your Ground laws, voter ID laws, anti-immigrant laws, and legislation that benefits private prisons, strips LGBTQ rights, protects tobacco companies, and environmental polluters, Alec has worked to promote the privatization of public services, including education. Indiana passed landmark education privatization legislation in 2011. It was such a success for conservatives that it prompted Alec to name their model education privatization legislation the Indiana Education Reform Package. Some political historians and academics point out that the voucher program, which supports private schools, was developed by Southern segregationists as a means to maintain white supremacist segregation in the American schooling system after the Brown v. Board of Education ruling, the Supreme Court ruling which made school segregation illegal. Here's a clip from the film Indiana's Choice. It takes a critical view of the voucher system. First, you'll hear Indiana University professor Chris Lubianski, then Emory University professor Steve Suet.
It's important to think about this question historically as well, that when you go back into the time after Brown versus Board of Education, school choice was initially held up and used in a number of states as a way to avoid integration. So it has segregation roots. And so that's important to remember.
My book, Overturning Brown, investigates what is today a well-financed, growing private school movement called school choice. And its advocates claim that they are advancing civil rights by promoting and urging states to adopt school voucher programs that send taxpayer money to private schools, often unregulated private schools. These voucher programs, in fact, are quite similar, are exactly the same, as the voucher programs which were first started by the Southern segregationists in the 1950s and 1960s in order to defeat the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. Not much has changed since the days of the Southern segregationists who created the original voucher programs. What has changed in a major way is the reach and size of government support. Today, we have 27 states, 11 in the South and 16 in other parts of the country. The states with voucher programs spend more than $2.1 billion each year. And that number is growing. They're growing with a legacy of the Southern segregationists.
The state senator for Monroe County, Shelley Yoder, has prioritized education issues throughout her candidacy and her first few months in office. She spoke with WFHB about Indiana House Bill 1005, and she highlighted the fact that private schools are not regulated like public schools. It could lead, she said, to issues like discrimination and a lack of transparency.
The voucher program, the charter schools, the private schools, there is no accountability. There is no transparency. Unlike public schools, where we have school boards that are elected by the people to make sure that their school corporations are run transparently and that people have a voice, we are giving money to schools that can actively discriminate based on sexual orientation, gender identity, race, religious beliefs. And that is not who we are. It's not what our Constitution says. And I have a real problem giving tax dollars to zero accountability.
Democratic lawmakers and teachers unions are among the groups putting pressure on Indiana's Republican lawmakers to reject the bill. But with the Republican supermajority in the state house, the bills have a fair chance at passing. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Comforti.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Jake Jacobson, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Aaron Comforti.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Catherine Patterson.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at WFHB.org.
The WFHB local news is also available as a podcast. Just search or call letters WFHB wherever you find your podcasts. Subscribe and never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for Planetary Radio, a program dedicated to exploring the depths of outer space. Coming up next on WFHB.
Listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@WFHB.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,